Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft are building up in fish found in the Great Lakes region. We'll find out why that's happening and some potential risks. First, Governor Walker signed a $3 billion incentive package for Foxconn Technology Group to build a plant in southeastern Wisconsin. He signed that yesterday. The hope from the governor is that the plant could be an economic boon with the potential to add 13,000 more jobs in the state. But there are still political arguments over the package and whether or not it'll be as lucrative as it's hoped. The plan does seem to have some strong support from the state's business community. The support is not just in the area in southeastern Wisconsin where the plant could be built. It's around the state. Tom Dakin joins us now to talk about support for Foxconn around Wisconsin. He's a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks, Rob.
Well, what are you seeing when you look at businesses and business groups around the state? What are they saying about Foxconn?
Well, I suppose it's pretty intuitive that most of them would support it. I mean, if you own a business, let's say in Wausau, for example, a company like Greenheck Fan Corporation, well, they make fans ventilation systems for large buildings. So naturally, they'd love to be able to sell some of that product for Foxconn's manufacturing facility, assuming that does get built in Mount Pleasant near Racine, as we expect it to be done. Similarly, I think you have other companies like, for example, in Janesville, where the head of Forward Janesville, which is essentially their Chamber of Commerce, their economic development agency, said they have employers there, businesses there that would like to be in the supply chain for Foxconn, which will need different vendors, not just to build the company, but to supply those operations once they're up and running.
And as you see surveys from groups like Forward Janesville, and I think you wrote about the La Crosse Chamber of Commerce and others, are they thinking this is going to be a huge windfall for us in our community, or, well, maybe we'll get a little spillover effect by supplying this big thing in the Racine area?
Yeah, I guess it depends where you're located. In the case of Janesville, I mean, Janesville is really roughly an hour's drive from where we think the plant's going to be built. We believe that's going to be just east of Interstate 94 in Mount Pleasant. I think if you have a company in Janesville that supplies components or parts or services to manufacturers, I think the chances of them getting a piece of the action are a lot better than if you're located, say, in La Crosse, which is, you know, clear, obviously, on the other side of the state. But, you know, that's not to say that people, business operators in La Crosse don't generally support it. They do. I mean, it would make sense. It ties in hand with a kind of a general belief what the rising tide raises all boats, as they say.
And did you hear any dissenting voices as you talked to people in the business community, people who weren't so on board, maybe not with Foxconn itself, but with the incentive package?
Right. I mean, well, Kevin Conroy is probably the best example. He's president and CEO of Madison-based Exact Sciences Corp., and Mr. Conroy wrote an opinion piece for the Journal Sentinel that we published about a week or two ago, where he said the deal's too expensive and it'll waste resources that could otherwise be used for, well, the basic things state government should be doing, roads, schools, healthcare, you name it. And I think a lot of that criticism, it's not just the amount of money, although the amount of money obviously is quite large, $2.85 billion with a B in direct payments to Foxconn. It's the time over which you get that money back. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau's report said essentially 25 years. That's a long time. That's a long time. And I think the business executives and owners who are opposed to this, they would look at their own experience and say, would I invest money in something that isn't going to truly pay back until 25 years down the road? I think the answer would obviously be no, they wouldn't. Particularly in an area where the technology can change relatively quickly. I guess in defense, you could point out that, well, the state tax credits, they don't get paid until jobs are created. But it is a criticism that's out there, that length of payback.
Talking to Tom Dakin, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the Foxconn deal, an incentive package signed off on by Governor Walker just yesterday, negotiations about to start. He's been looking at reaction around the state, especially in the business community. Tom, how about in your own backyard? You're in Milwaukee there, just up the street, so to speak, from where this thing could get built. What's the reaction been in the Milwaukee area?
Well, publicly, I would say nary a negative voice is heard, and some of that is, I think, well, some of it's a sincere belief that this is a good investment for southeastern Wisconsin. I would say some of it is probably predicated on the belief that Foxconn might do additional investments, and people don't want to obviously be seen publicly criticizing something that they want to get a piece of. You know, there's been talk of maybe Foxconn will do an office building in Milwaukee. I don't know if that's going to happen, truthfully, but there are developers out there who are making their pitches. As a matter of fact, at yesterday's signing event, who would show up other than Peter Fagan, president of the Milwaukee Bucks? And part of the reason Peter was there, and I talked to him briefly afterwards, is you may know, your listeners may know, that the Milwaukee Bucks, in addition to building the new arena right now and the parking structure, they own additional land in downtown Milwaukee, the old Park East Strip. Some of it has already been developed for their new practice facility and a new Frater Medical College of Wisconsin Health Clinic, but there's some additional land that has yet to be developed, and I think the Bucks would like to maybe try and do an office building there, and, well, who better to anchor that than Foxconn? At least that's the pitch being made. Nothing definitive yet, obviously, but it's just an example of something that might happen.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about local communities hoping that Foxconn would kind of bring secondary business to their area. They might supply Foxconn, but there's been talk not just in Milwaukee. Madison came up at some point. Other communities hoping to get not the main deal, not the big show that the Racine area is getting, but secondary Foxconn facilities. Are a lot of communities starting to try to get their names into the mix there?
You know, honestly, other than Milwaukee and Madison, I don't know of any others. And frankly, as a journalist, I guess my feeling is, let's see what happens first with the one we know or we think is going to happen, and that's going to be the one that eventually is going to pop probably in the next week or two. I think we'll finally get a specific definitive proposal for a site in, like I said, in Mount Pleasant.
Now, you write a lot about development in the Milwaukee area in particular. Is there any sense that all this attention to Foxconn, deserved attention, it's a big deal, but that it's taking the air out of the room, overshadowing a lot of other stuff that might be going on?
No, I wouldn't make that statement. I mean, I write about plenty of other projects, and they seem to get those stories seem to be well read based on the numbers we see in which we can measure readership interest. So, yes, a lot of energy is being expended on Foxconn. A lot of news media attention justified is being centered on Foxconn, but we're covering a lot of other things as well.
Well, I want to go to the cliche, the devil is in the details, Tom. What kind of details are you watching for when it comes to Foxconn as you start to look at what the economic impact might be?
Well, I'd say two things. The state legislation has been signed, but there still has to be the development of, or I should say the negotiation of what effectively is a development agreement, a contract between the company and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corp. That'll probably provide more details on how the money gets distributed and the benchmarks for providing that. In addition to that, once again, we think Mount Pleasant is where this is going, Mount Pleasant slash Sturdivant, a village that's on the border of Mount Pleasant, there will be I'm sure, a proposal for a tax incremental financing district to help pay for the, at the very least, the public infrastructure that will be needed to supply the Foxconn complex. And infrastructure is a long, boring word that means roads, sewers, and water mains, right? And that'll have to have a lot of details spelled out as to how much money will be spent and when those communities can expect that money to be repaid through the TIF district.
We'll leave it there for now. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you very much, Rob.
We've been talking to Tom Dakin, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the Foxconn deal and the reaction, the support in many cases from businesses around Wisconsin. Coming up, a new study finds that the antidepressants people take are building up in the brains of fish found in the Great Lakes system. We'll learn about the potential risks to the environment. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, a new study has found that the antidepressants we take, things like Prozac and Zoloft, are building up in fish found in the Niagara River, which connects the two easternmost Great Lakes. The drugs are entering rivers and lakes from treatment plants and sewage overflows. Antidepressants in fish brains don't seem to pose any immediate human health risks, but they could alter ecosystems, behaviors of animals, too. Diana Aga is a lead scientist on the study that was published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. She's a chemistry professor and director of graduate studies in chemistry at the University of Buffalo. Diana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So how are antidepressants finding their way into the Niagara River, presumably other waterways as well, in the first place?
Yeah, so they're mainly coming from effluents from wastewater treatment plants. And those are basically coming from our own homes. When people take these drugs and they pee, and also sometimes their excess, they flush it in the toilet, they end up going to wastewater treatment plants, which are not really equipped to remove them. And so they end up being discharged in surface waters.
I think a lot of people might think wastewater treatment plants treat wastewater for just about anything. But what you found is that no, in fact, this is antidepressants, other medications, they aren't treated at all. Is that right?
That's correct. So the main purpose of wastewater treatment plants is really to remove nitrogen, dissolved carbon, phosphorus. So the system is designed to do that, but not to remove pharmaceuticals and other what we call organopollutants, and that includes antidepressants.
So you and your colleagues looked at fish in the Niagara River in particular. This connects Lake Erie to Lake Ontario, if I remember my geography right. What did you find when you started to look at the fish there?
Well, we found all sorts of things. We actually looked for several types of pharmaceuticals, but what really stood up is the high levels of antidepressants. When we found that they were almost 500 times higher than the other chemicals we're looking for, which included antibiotics, caffeine, analgesics, antihistamines, the concentrations of the antidepressants were much higher.
And it sounds like from your study, antidepressants in fish, in the brains of fish, were much higher than the surrounding water itself, too.
That's correct. So we observed this so-called bioaccumulation, and they were highest mostly in brain. The levels in the brain was almost 1,000 to 2,000 fold higher than what we found in the surface water.
So as these fish are consuming, or I guess even breathing in effect through their gills, the antidepressants are going in, they're accumulating in their brains, and there's no system in the fish that removes it again.
Correct. So because they're exposed 24/7, even if they are capable of metabolizing or degrading these compounds in their body, the rate of metabolism is probably much slower than the rate they're accumulating that from exposure in water. So in the end, it's concentrating and it's bioaccumulating in their brain.
Now let's talk about, I think the thing that people would worry about first of all is, gosh, if I eat these fish, am I taking antidepressants? It sounds like at least that part of our worries isn't a big worry, right?
That's correct. A lot of people actually ask me about that. So the levels for us are much lower, and it should not really elicit toxic effects in humans. Plus, I think most people do not really eat the brain, although there are some cultures that use the head to make soup. But in general, in the U.S., typically we remove the head and then we don't consume it. So I'm not worried about fish consumption and accumulating of these drugs in humans.
Can you talk about the kind of concentrations that are there in fish? How much is there? And is it there at a level that's going to affect the fish themselves adversely?
Yeah, yes, definitely. So the levels we're detecting in brain are between 200 to 500 nanograms per grams of the brain. And at these levels, it has been shown in laboratory studies that these levels are actually enough to affect a lot of the behavior of the fish, from their swimming behavior, their feeding behavior, their ability to capture prey or recognize predators, and so on. So these levels are concerning for fish.
We're talking to Diana Aga from the University of Buffalo, lead researcher on a new study in the journal Environmental Science and Technology, finding antidepressants, showing up in the brains of fish in the Great Lakes system. Diana, you focused your research on the Niagara River. It's part of the Great Lakes chain. Is this something you would expect to find if you started to look in other lakes and rivers along that line?
Definitely. In fact, maybe even more so, because we were actually expecting it to be lower in Niagara River because the dilution is so much. So we were thinking it to be lower. So if you think about some smaller rivers where dilution is less, you could expect the concentrations to be higher, in fact.
And let's talk about the impact this has on the fish. You were talking about this being enough to affect the behavior of fish. Can you talk about the kind of effect that could have on fish species and the ecosystem in general?
Yeah, so there are some evidence that sometimes when the fish have these levels in their brain, they actually have the decreased ability to capture prey. And they also have been shown that they are affected physiologically, that they can no longer respond to environmental stress. They also invoke changes in swimming behavior and their feeding behavior. In fact, there are some evidence also that sometimes the fish actually swim towards the light, so they are more exposed to predators.
So they might think, oh, a predator, no big deal on the one hand, but also they might be drawn to predators because of antidepressants in their brain.
Exactly, yes.
Well, let's talk about what to do about this. You mentioned our wastewater treatment plants don't treat for antidepressants or other pharmaceuticals. Is that part of the answer here? Is it possible? Is there technology that would allow a wastewater treatment plant to filter these drugs out?
There are. In fact, I've been doing some research, related research on other pharmaceuticals for more than 15 years now, focusing on removal of antibiotics and other drugs. And there are advanced treatment systems that can remove them. They are not cheap, of course, and it might involve redesigning of the wastewater treatment plants or introducing some other more sophisticated treatment systems, such as using ozonation or membrane bioreactors or other advanced oxidation process that will involve, you know, money for changing the wastewater treatment systems.
Yeah, can you talk about the kind of scale of expense that would be? That doesn't sound like cheap technology to me.
Correct. I know I'm working with an advanced treatment systems. They're actually spending almost, I think, $3 million to install some of this, and they're testing it now in the pilot scale. So I think as we see more and more of these pharmaceuticals in the environment and finding more and more effects on the ecology, I think there will be some, these are good drivers to renovate and improve wastewater treatment plants, especially those that are aging.
And then what about disposal of medications? I know you said some of this is just biological. If you take these medications and then excrete them one way or another, that's going to end up in the system. You hear sometimes people disposing of medications by flushing them. Is that part of the story here?
Yes. So that's definitely a big part of it, especially when people die and they dump the excess or expired drugs also. That's definitely a big contributor. However, there are now more and more cities that actually do drug collection. Even pharmaceutical stores or drug stores or grocery stores like Wegman, they do monthly drug collection. They advertise that to promote awareness that these excess drugs in the environment are not good for fish and wildlife.
And we've been focusing on antidepressants, but as you mentioned earlier, you've been on the lookout for a while now for antibiotics, antibiotic medications. Are we seeing this as a problem in freshwater ecosystems like the Great Lakes?
Yes. In fact, that was the main purpose for my study, was look for antibiotics, because the problem for the antibiotics is the development of drug resistance. The low levels of antibiotics in water is perfect condition to create resistant pathogens. So that's been a big concern in my research lab is how to remove antibiotics so that we don't create superbugs.
Are the answers for keeping antidepressants out of the water similar to keeping antibiotics out of the water, treatment, better disposal?
Yes, they are actually going to be very similar. So, in fact, if the wastewater treatment plants are improved, a lot of these drugs, all kinds of active ingredients will be probably removed, including endocrine disruptors, you know, like hormones that are being taken that are also affecting fish population. So the answer to many of these problems is improved wastewater treatment.
Staying with the antibiotics for a moment, and you mentioned the risk of drug-resistant diseases forming. Is this something that you worry, you know, you could get this organism forming a drug resistance and antibiotic resistance and then ending up back in the human population?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's actually been shown that that happens because this constant introduction of this mixture of antibiotics at low levels. So they basically kill the susceptible bacteria, and the ones that are resistant survive. So there's an increase in the percent of resistant bacteria in receiving waters from wastewater treatment plants. So that's a big concern.
As we start to wrap up, Diana, what is the next step in your research on pharmaceuticals in the Great Lakes system?
Well, we're planning on expanding actually the study area, and at the same time, we are looking at improved levels of wastewater treatment. That's been my main research, actually, is what we can do to remove many of these micropollutants in the environment.
We'll leave it there for now. Diana, thanks a lot for joining us today and sharing your research.
Thank you for having me.
Diana Aga is a chemistry professor at the University of Buffalo. She led a study that found a buildup of antidepressant drugs in the brains of fish in the Great Lakes region. That study was published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology, as we heard. She's also concerned about antibiotics and other pharmaceuticals finding their way into the Great Lakes. Coming up after the news, computer game developer Zoe Quinn joins the show to talk about the coordinated campaign of online threats, harassment, and intimidation that turned her life upside down. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Computer game developer Zoe Quinn's life was turned upside down 3 years ago last month. An abusive ex posted an angry online manifesto about her, and that manifesto spread online. Soon she was the target of a coordinated online campaign of harassment, threats, and intimidation, with personal contact info released online and rape threats and death threats arriving in online forums, emails, and phone calls. The campaign became known as Gamergate. It spread to target her friends, family members, and anyone who publicly defended her. A lot of people, including people in the legal system, told her she should just leave the internet. She didn't. Instead, she started the Crash Override Network, a crisis hotline and advocacy group for other people facing similar threats. Zoe Quinn's games include Depression Quest. Her new book is Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I briefly described, Zoe, what you went through, and it's hard to do it justice. Can you talk about the kinds of intimidation and threats that you faced and how it affected your life?
Sure. I mean, it was everything from people sending me like disgusting sexually charged messages to threats of sexual violence and death to in-person stalking, harassing my family, getting my home address, my phone number, getting that of my family, and, you know, calling that constantly, spreading nude photos of me that they would sometimes do gross stuff to. You know, like it's harder to think of what didn't happen. Pretty much anything you can do with another to another person using a computer, I kind of went through.
And you literally, in effect, lived in hiding for a while, right?
Yeah, for I believe 7 months, if I can try to pull that off the top of my head. All this started going down when I was away from my apartment. And when people were sort of like outside, like after they found out my home address and were kind of waiting for me to come back, I was like, okay, well, clearly I can't go back. I should wait for this, you know, to die down. And then after months and months and months, it was clear that that wasn't going to be the case. So I ended up having to move.
What do you know about who did this? Who was behind this very coordinated campaign of harassment and threats?
Aside from my ex, who was like kind of cheerleading a lot of it during it, you know, he would have like a week, you know, harassment is bad disclaimer while feeding more information to the mob and encouraging them to use different tactics. There were, you know, it's hard to say there's any one specific type of person. You get like the people who just like maybe send a mean message and then never think about it again because maybe their buddies are, or they think they're like super funny or whatever. And then you've got the people who like have a very specific vendetta that are sort of against usually something they think that I represent rather than me personally, that will like kind of be symbolically attacking me as like a convenient placeholder for this thing they already feel anxious and messed up about. And then you have like the people who are kind of like ringleaders in the mob and sort of using this to like start building an online brand, and some of these people merchandise. Usually they do it under their legal name. And that's like online harassment is kind of becoming a cottage industry with people sort of spearheading those efforts.
And leaders of what became this Gamergate movement, an informal movement, I guess, claimed this had something to do with the phrase was ethics in gaming journalism. And so that manifesto from your ex claimed that you had slept with a game critic for good reviews, though the person in question never actually reviewed any of your work. So what do you see as the motivation behind what became Gamergate?
It's kind of funny. Like the manifesto actually didn't make that accusation. That
was
just something.
The original. Okay.
Yeah, like it wasn't, I think, until a few days in that somebody else just retroactively decided that must have happened because, you know, women can't make games or whatever the reason was. The fact that that review never existed never seemed to matter. So Gamergate really, and this was very much like, seemed like by design by my ex, capitalized on this sort of growing background resentment towards anybody that's not, you know, conceived of as the default in someone's mind. And that's usually like basically the further that you get from a 1950s sitcom dad, the more of an other you are. And that's not unique to gaming by any means. And neither was Gamergate. A lot of the participants had no stake in the video games industry whatsoever or didn't even play games. Like the name comes from the actor Adam Baldwin, who tweeted out a weird YouTube conspiracy video about how I was somehow manipulating an entire industry with makeouts with the hashtag Gamergate. And he doesn't even play video games. So really it just was like this anti-progressive sentiment. And I was like being attacked as a symbol of, you know, progress that maybe people resented or didn't understand or feared because it was different.
We're talking to Zoe Quinn, author of Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe, one of the many surreal things about your story is as this is going on, I mean, you're a savvy internet user. You were able to go to some of these online forums that most of us don't know exist and watch people in real time plotting out their next course of attack against you. Can you talk about what that was like?
It was difficult. You know, I'm best known for a game about having depression. So, you know, if you're familiar at all with how depression works, it's you've got this thing that I like to call trash brain, just kind of whispering all these things to you and trying to undermine your victories and be like, oh, people don't really like you and stuff like that. So having that sort of externalized like this and like fed back to me by thousands of strangers, like 24/7, was really hard to accept. And there was a part of me that was like, yeah, I knew it. I knew nobody could actually like me. I knew everybody that supported me was like either lying or they just didn't know that I'm like this horrible monster that my depression tells me I am. And I was so sure that everything was over. And that, you know, that was the end of the road for me.
And you made this game about depression. You've not been, you've been public about dealing with depression. People came to an online forum related to your game to talk about their own problems with depression. And then some of the people in this anti-you movement basically tried to use that. They tried to trigger your depression. They, I believe you wrote that they went to this forum and tried to convince people there who had depression to kill themselves?
Yeah, it was a major thing in the attacks, both against me and part of it was like, oh, if we can isolate her from anybody who supports her or likes her, then she'll be more likely to, you know, actually kill herself. So let's try to do that.
And you were counseled by people you knew, others, a magistrate when you tried to take this into the justice system. So just get off the internet, get off the online world. What was your reaction to that?
When in the case of hearing that from a judge, I was like, well, Your Honor, I'm an independent video game developer. There's not actually an offline version of that. So essentially, you're asking me to give up my career. And he said, oh, you're a smart young kid. Find a new career.
We could spend a lot of time talking about what you went through, but I also want to talk about what you've done in response. And one of the things you did was start the Crash Override Network. Tell us about that.
Crash Override Network was sort of born out of like that monitoring that we had been doing for so long of the attacks against me. And as it quickly spread out to so many other people, we were sort of trying to get, you know, as we were like quietly documenting all of it, we would see who they were going to next and like try to warn them. And, you know, we were familiar with sort of what would happen because it had already happened to us. So we'd be like, oh here, make sure you do this, this, and this, and it'll make it harder for people to try to like get into your accounts or find your personal information or find your family. And after a few months of doing that, it was like, okay, well, maybe we can like try to formalize this into sort of a grassroots organization and create guides and basically like give the world the tools that we have at our disposal and make it, you know, make the thing that we wish existed when we were targeted. And, you know, since what happened with me blew up so big that like, you know, I spoke at the U.S. House of Representatives and the United Nations. So many people who had been through this sort of abuse had come forward to me and were like, oh, I feel like you're the only person who understands, you know, what I went through. So it was really apparent how many how common this stuff is and how where exactly the failings were. So it's like trying to figure out how to fill those gaps in while we push for institutional change and, you know, use the networked nature of the internet that, you know, can enable abuse like this to do the opposite, to look after each other and protect each other and build resiliency in our communities and teach people good digital hygiene and self-defense.
Yeah, your story was one of maybe the two or three most famous stories of this kind of online mob-style harassment. But how common is it? How many people are you hearing from who have been through some version of what you went through?
See, that's the thing, is like the internet is, you know, it's an extension of everyday life. So all of the bad stuff that happens offline can bleed into online just as easily and, you know, vice versa. So it's really common with domestic violence and abuse cases now for, you know, abuse that starts offline to continue online, like both in my case and in plenty of others. It's really common. There's a whole thing with non-consensual intimate imagery where people have nude photos of you and then you break up and then they start spreading them around. And, you know, it's the same for hate crimes and, you know, people of color, especially trans women of color, get the most hatred and violence both online and offline. So it's really just a mirror of the offline world.
Zoe Quinn is with us. Her new book is Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been the target of online harassment or threats? How did you react? What did that do to you? Did the authorities, whether an internet service provider, a social media site, legal authorities, help in any way if you reached out to them? What do you think could or should change to deal with this kind of online harassment and intimidation? Call in now at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Here's some advice from Zoe Quinn coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Zoe Quinn, computer game developer. She was the target of an online campaign of threats and harassment starting just over 3 years ago. She writes about her experience in her book, Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life, How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. She's also the founder of the Crash Override Network, which aims to help people going through a similar situation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'd like to hear from you if you've been through this or witnessed this kind of online intimidation. And if you work in schools or law enforcement or social media, let us know your perspective and how your organization deals with these issues at 800-642-1234. 1234. Zoe, I want to get your thoughts. When we hear about, you know, bullying in schools, people talk about a lot about the bystanders and what the third party can do to help out. In this case of online intimidation and threats, is there something where somebody sees this happening that they can do that's actually helpful?
Oh, absolutely. That's actually the most helpful thing that we've seen throughout all of the casework that I've helped handle is the biggest thing that tends to be a good predictor of a more positive and healthy outcome for the person affected is having community support around them that's sort of savvy, that knows what's up, which is really cool because it's like, you know, governments, big tech industry, like all of those are big institutions that take a long time to change and adapt and grow. But, you know, taking care of each other is something that we can do right now and we don't have to wait to do. So, you know, all of it really comes down to the person who's being directly affected. You know, there's a lot of different things, a lot of different feelings and responses people have to this sort of attack on themselves. So, you know, one person might want someone to stand up and like say something, and another person might just want to, you know, get it to go away and be distracted or have it removed. So really the biggest thing is to center the consent and specific needs of the person targeted before, you know, just jumping in. And another thing to do is to just going beyond when somebody is being actively targeted, build these sort of resilient channels into our community as we go. So, you know, get familiar with people in your life. If you see somebody having a hard time, like just reach out and check in and be like, hey, I'm thinking of you. Or, you know, be loud and make sure that people know that you're there to help if the worst does come to pass. And similarly, like have hard conversations with people in your life if they are, you know, maybe spreading disinformation or being, or, you know, behaving badly, being, you know, like being part of the problem, or even just like, you know, being a little bit ignorant of the problem, do what you can to educate people.
Yeah, you write that you had a time in your life, I think in high school, where you write that you were unpleasant to people and you learned better, you changed. And you say that suggests to you that it's really important to find out what's motivating people who are doing this and not just think of them as those people.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you turn it into a good person, bad person dichotomy, then, you know, the so-called bad people can't ever grow and change and, you know, become something else. And the so-called good people get off the hook for, you know, actually hurtful behavior. So focusing more on the ways that we treat each other and trying to build nuance back into the internet, I think, is such a crucial thing. Like nuance and empathy are like two big things that seem to be, they quickly go by the wayside anytime there's any critical mass of people involved with stuff.
Let's bring on a caller now. David is with us in Appleton. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is my nephew was both cyber and physically bullied in high school. And it was one of the things where, you know, everybody, they have all these programs for anti-bullying in the schools, but what they don't realize is that cyberbullying can have the same effect. And there should be something that should go into effect where they can backtrack the ISP from the bully and have some kind of punishment for his actions like they do for physical bullies.
David, thanks for bringing that up. Zoe, any thoughts on cyberbullying where in a school, you know, you could get bullied all day at school and then bullied all night online?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that happened to your nephew. It's really unfortunate. And that's sort of where a big kind of gap that needs to be closed right now on this issue is, you know, segmenting it out in between online and offline stuff when it's like a lot of the stuff does start, you know, in real life from people who know the person targeted. So, you know, without, you know, accidentally, like the internet's like kind of a complicated thing when it comes to matters of privacy and being able to obtain private information and locating people. That's like a whole big thing. I think that it's important for the people that are teaching our kids that, you know, have these programs that are anti-bullying that focus on in-person bullying also start to sort of adapt to a modern age where, you know, that continues into the offline life. So it's like a lot of older systems for that sort of thing really need to be retrofitted and, you know, kind of caught up to date.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Zoe Quinn. Her new book is Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe, a weird sequel to your story. A lot of the people and platforms involved in the campaign against you, the threats against you, there's a lot of overlap with that and what we now know as the alt-right. And the website Breitbart was a frequent host of attacks against you. And so it's entered into the political world, too.
Yeah, it was really kind of hit a critical mass as soon as it spread into this what we're calling the alt-right now circle, which was weird because it was the actor Adam Baldwin that, you know, started that, and he had a big following in that circle. And then Breitbart, they have like their own custom art and tag for me and stuff like that. It's really bizarre because it's like I'm just an independent game developer. It's very weird to be hyper fixated on random people, but that happens all the time. It's harkens back to this cottage industry of harassment. It ties very neatly into that sort of tabloid journalism of practicing 2 minutes hate against specific people, 1984 style, except it's like instead of the government mandating it, it's private citizens and companies that are profiting off of it. And it was very weird to see, you know, how much steam Breitbart was able to gather in sort of younger, more tech-savvy crowds that they had not previously really cornered the market on yet, by, you know, dipping their toe into coming after what was happening to me, and how that spread out to other this like constellation of networked groups that hate different kinds of people recreationally as like a community thing, and then like entering into that whole sphere was really like kind of escalated things to an even more dangerous place, because that's where like you're dealing with Stormfront and neo-Nazis and like people that, you know, the same places that Dylan Roof and Elliot Rodger and a lot of people who go on to commit in-person violence just based on, you know, like hate crimes like post. It was really kind of terrifying.
Yeah, and that's one of the many most chilling things about your story and other people going through this. When somebody makes a threat of physical violence against you, you can't tell if it's just some teenager showing off to his friends or the next Dylan Roof or other you know, mass homicide perpetrator.
Yeah, and it only takes being wrong once to lose everything.
So when you look at the people who own the tubes of the internet, if you will, the social media companies, the internet service providers, are there things you'd like to see from them that could help with all this?
Absolutely. It's frustrating because a lot of platforms have terms of service that, you know, don't want that, like in name, don't allow this sort of thing to happen. Like it's not, you know, they've made terms of service saying, hey, like, you know, we have anti-harassment policies and stuff, but they don't actually enforce it. And what they seem to deem harassment keeps being like a moving goalpost. And really the difficulty is that the internet runs on this economy of attention where, you know, the amount of traffic to a website or engagement with a specific piece of content online is seen as value. And at the end of the day, it's just making numbers go up. And it doesn't really matter if those numbers are going up because people are like trying to hurt someone or because people found something that they genuinely enjoy. And, you know, it's such a tricky thing to try to work around because one of my biggest worries is that there will be over broad legislation that will completely stop the ability of the internet to function, or will, you know, think that anonymity is the problem when it's not, and like unmask the like, oh, if we can just unmask these people, everything would be fine. And it's like, actually, anonymity is good for people like me that need to hide from people like that. And privacy is a great thing. So I'd like to see more attention paid to, instead of like focusing on specific individual people who are participating in harassment, holding companies accountable to their own guidelines in terms of service. And you don't even need to get into the whole free speech versus harassment arguments. You can just make it a quality issue, like a consumer safety thing. It's like, was this platform designed with this sort of behavior in mind? If not, then it needs to be tweaked. And that's you know, that's how spam was handled in the early 90s. And advertisements are way more of like way more free speech than death threats, which are not actually protected speech. But it was like there was so much spamming of these advertisements that it was impeding the ability for certain things to function.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to Zoe Quinn. Her new book is Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. This time of year, a lot of people around Wisconsin are facing a common problem: what to do with all the produce in the garden or from the CSA or that we bought at the market, because it's so darn cheap this time of year. So, you know, you might have the big bag of tomatoes or the overgrown zucchini that took off while you weren't around. So what do you do with that stuff? We want to hear from you, and I'll share one of my things. You've heard me talk about my zucchini relish a couple times on the show. Over at the front page of WPR.org, we've got a link to the Blue Ribbon Zucchini Relish from the original author of that recipe. She says you can maybe omit the onions. I leave the onions in. This is a great way to use up that zucchini. It's just a fridge pickle. You don't need to process it. So go check it out there. And then while you're there, let us know what you are doing, what you have too much of, and how you use it up. Or maybe you look like WPR's offices and every day in the break room there's a pile of random produce. I put in my overload of hot peppers and mint today from the CSA. And I had a scene the other day. I saw my neighbor. I saw him buy his tomato plants. I saw him look at me, and I knew he was going to try to unload tomatoes on me when I was trying to get rid of some of my own. Again, find that zucchini relish recipe and share your vegetable overload over on the front page at WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.